Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Bulak, produced by Sout. We have a great show today, looking at comics and graphic novels from the Arab region and specifically from Lebanon. We'll be talking with Rawand Issa about her wonderful book, Inside the Giant Fish, and about creating comics and graphic novels today. Before we get started, just a quick thank you to those of you who have already donated to our 2023 fundraising campaign. We really appreciate it. Bulak is a labor of love, a show put together by two freelancers. We've been doing this for about 5 years now, and we're almost at episode number 100. If you'd like to support us, you can make a donation at donorbox.org/support-Bulak. Again, that's donorbox.org/support-Bulak. That link is also on our Twitter and in the show notes for this episode. We really would like to keep the show going and to keep it free and available to everyone. We figure if about half our listeners gave just $10 for the year, we could meet our goal. Also, if you don't already, you should subscribe to the show on one of the many podcast platforms we're available on. You can follow us on Twitter at Bulak Books, where we post about new episodes, but also regularly share news and commentary on Arabic literature and translation. And finally, you can also now follow us on Instagram at bulak.books.
Hello and welcome to episode 98 of the Bulak podcast. I'm Marshalinx Kweli, coming to you today from Rabat, Morocco. And as usual, I'm joined by Ursula Lindsay and Amon Jordan. And today we're also joined by comics artist Rawand Issa, who's coming to us from Istanbul. For those of you who don't know her, Rawand is an artist, comic artist, and writer from the town of Al-Jeh, Lebanon. Her work focuses on socioeconomic issues and documenting real stories. She's published political cartoons and comics in a number of magazines, as well as several short graphic novels, including Insubordinate and Not From Mars. Her latest work is the graphic novel Inside the Giant Fish, which has been translated to English by Amy Shinyara and published by Mamoul Press, which you can find at mamoulpress.com. So thank you so much for joining us today, Rawand. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, great. So if you can start us off by talking about, I know you started out in journalism and then moved into comics art and, you know, sometimes work between journalism and comics art. And I wanted to know, you know, just if you could tell us why journalism, why comics art, and, you know, where you've been and where you're going.
Yeah. I started in journalism, although I didn't really studied it in a university, but I got a training from a very important at the time, a very important local newspaper, Al-Safir. They used to do training for young writers. So I got my journalism training there. And I started really early in journalistic writing. After 3-4 years, I then started to produce comics, and I don't think that my switch was very far away from journalism, because what I do in comics is also comics journalism, or what we can call comics journalism, because I do nonfiction comics and I do documentation, political comics, which is also, I think it's in the same field, like in the same media field, where I'm also doing some kind of journalism.
Great. So what about the shift to also doing fictional works? Because Inside the Giant Fish, as you noted to me, is not, you know, your own story, but rather a sort of a fictional story.
Yeah. Well, it's based on real stories. I mean, I don't know how to explain this switch. It's just that, like, after producing comics for a while, you kind of want to explore new things, and deciding to create something bigger than just a comic strip, and which can be a book in this situation. This is where I think that things kind of happen organically. Like, I didn't decide to do this on purpose. And also, this Inside the Giant Fish is also based on real life stories. So it's the character is fictional, but the whole stories are real. I kind of did an interview with different people from my hometown, and family members and neighbors, and kind of put all the stories together into one character. But they're all real.
Mm. So perhaps for our listeners, could talk about what the subject of Inside the Giant Fish is.
Yeah, so it's the story of a girl who is looking for her memories on a beach that doesn't exist anymore, and it's between the past, which is in 80s, 90s, and right now, the present time, where she does not live in her hometown anymore. And the main story is about privatizing the beach of her hometown, and how the whole people of the hometown kind of lost a big part of their lives when they lost the beach.
Yeah, I don't know about other readers, but I felt so outraged that it feels like a human right to have access to your own beach, to have access to the water, to be able to swim in the water that's so nearby, and to see it, you know, the sort of razor wire come up. And you know, it's so spiky, like so many things in that graphic novel are spiky. it's so outrageous.
It's also part of something that's happening, like, in so many, I mean, around the world, and very dramatically in the region. Right? Like, yes, in a lot of places that we know, in a lot of cities that we love, just this confiscation of what should be a public resource, which is like access to clean, beautiful public spaces, you know, beaches, forests, like, you know, it's green space, open space, like access to water. I mean, it's a real war, I feel like, on citizens, yes, and residents, that's happening, like, by developers and by governments, and you're not the only one to have focused on this, but the story you tell is very bittersweet and very moving, and maybe about a part of Lebanon that I was not familiar with. Like, I was familiar with the fights over public beaches in Beirut, the movement to save, like, the last public beach in Beirut. But I did not know this particular story of development in other parts of the country.
Yeah, exactly. Somehow it's even sadder in this village, where the beach is such an important part of life, and they can't, you know, do so many other things.
Yeah, so what happened with my hometown is not exceptional. It's happening, like you said, all around the region. Everything is becoming privatized, and you have to, like, in order to access any natural things in your environment, you have to pay for it. So, which encouraged me more to write about the story, because like you said, what we have in Lebanon is a fight to keep the rest of the open spaces or the public spaces in Lebanon. And how we talk about this, like when we, for example, in journalism, when we want to talk about what's happening, we talk about it more of being a cause of a human right. We need to fight about this. But I felt like the intimate part of this and what actually happened to individuals and the drastic change that happens to people's life, we don't talk much about this. It's not only like when we say a human right fight, it's kind of, I don't know, it's like kind of a big label that you can't actually connect with it sometimes on a personal level. So I just wanted to show what it really means, what a human right fight really means. It means that a lot of people are losing a big part of their lives. They're losing a big part of their identity. They're losing their heritage. Again, it's not only losing an access to the beach, it's losing an access to a whole life that they used to live.
Yeah, it's like an important integral part of the culture that now, you know, changes everything. But also another part of your work that I think, you know, sort of in general of your work that I find in this book as well is the emphasis on the body. So it's also, you know, what being away from the water does to the main character's body, and how something plays out sort of physically on the individual body, and you have all this, you know, so much wonderful work around sort of particularly a woman's body. And I wanted to know, you know, how you move between this sort of exterior sort of, you know, sort of classically political to the interior, which is also political of, you know, sort of the fight over the space of the human body.
I'm smiling right now because I'm really happy that you like noticed all these details, small details in the illustrations. And yeah, I definitely talked about, like, when we talk about the land and the body, they're kind of, in my mind, or even realistically, they're in, like, in the same I don't know, territory. Like when the land is being privatized, also we lose part of our actual physical bodies, because privatizing a land is not something exterior from what your life is, from your, what you are a human. I don't know if I'm explaining it right, but one thing is that I wanted to show that if you are a person who lives by the beach, you kind of, like, having this open space, it's kind of having also your own personal space that is wide. Like, you have the freedom to move with your body in this open space. It feels like your body is free physically. You can swim, you can, I don't know, fish, you can do a lot of exercise. But, like, physically, you are kind of not in a very tiny space. You're taking space. You're taking the space that you need to take in order to live. But when it's privatized, it's kind of also puts borders around your own body. You can't take space anymore to live. So when you're privatizing land, you're also kind of putting borders on my body, because where am I going to move anymore? Like, I can't move anymore. I have no land to actually take space.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about your art style. And you have, and I just, you know, would say that for me as a kid, I was turned off comics in some way, because so many of the women characters that were supposed to be powerful were so like curvy and soft and, you know, with like these like impossibly large bosoms and impossibly tiny waists that, you know, just didn't seem like powerful or interesting to me in any way. And, but I love your sort of angular, sharp-edged, heavy-lined, you know, as you know, I love that there's hair on the legs of the girl, you know, as she's going out to swim, and that there's, you know, people have real eyebrows, for instance. and I wondered, you know, if you could talk a little bit about the development of your style, particularly of human figuration, but in general.
Yeah, this kind of also happened organically, like with time, because when I started drawing, I was very frustrated about having to, like, if you want to learn drawing, you have to learn the anatomy of the body. And like, when you learn anatomy of the body, you kind of, they put like a very perfect body model in front of you to draw. And like, you have to also deal with perspective and, like the length of the body, how much space it's taking on the paper. And for me, it wasn't realistic. Like, it was odd that the realistic drawing in this case wasn't realistic for me, because I don't look like the model I need to draw. So I kind of, it started when I was taking like drawing class, and then I dropped off. I didn't continue anymore because I felt like it's not something that I want to do. I felt frustrated, and I just started sketching on my own because I also was influenced by illustrators and comic artists, like from other generations. And I looked at their drawings, and they weren't realistic. So I was kind of had the courage to do the same, to not, when I want to draw, to not to aim for a realistic, which is not realistic, drawing. Let me say perfectionist drawing, maybe not realistic. So I started drawing on my own. And when I started drawing, of course, it wasn't like how I draw now. Of course, with practice, you kind of learn new things and you get like kind of advanced in how you draw. But this is how my hand movement was. It was kind of edgy and sharp, and I kind of wanted to draw what I see, which is, for example, first thing, my face, the faces that I see, and they weren't soft. My face is not soft. We have eyebrows, we have curly hairs, we have curly hair, we have we're big, we're small, so. I was very much influenced by real life around me and like the people that I see in myself as well. So it all happened from here. And then with time, with practice, with drawing more, it kind of like became what you see right now. But at first, it wasn't easy. Like, I think this is what every artist also go through when they're trying to discover their style. Like, it's not an easy thing to start, but like with me, it kind of happened organically because I was frustrated that I didn't want to draw this perfectionist body. Yeah, it happened from there, and then it kind of organically, I don't know, got to what I draw right now. Maybe it happened because like I didn't try more than how my hands were moving.
I mean, inside the giant fish, which is the work of yours that I've had the chance to see, is I think the style works really wonderfully also to sort of convey these inner worlds of like memory and sort of emotion. I mean, there's, you know, everyday scenes of things happening, but then there's these kind of beautiful panels that just feature a sun and a sea and a whale, and they are beautiful panels. I mean, they are like, you know,
thank you.
Paintings, works of art, things, you know, and then you have this very pretty limited and really dramatic color palette. I think you have maybe four or five colors throughout, and they complement each other, and they make this kind of really vivid scene. And then the ocean with all of these lines. Like, I love the way you just draw the water. So I think it conveys feeling also, like,
exactly.
When
we think about feelings, go ahead.
Yeah. When we think about feelings, I don't think I don't know. In my mind, they're not soft shape. Like, if we're talking about anger, loss, joy, nostalgia. In my mind, they're not soft at all. They are heavy feelings. Everything that is related to our, like, intimate memory, they're not soft at all. And I think this is where, like, also the sharp lines come from, because whenever I'm writing anything about these feelings, I'm not in a very comfortable mode. I'm in a lot of when I was working about Inside the Giant Fish, the whole time I was in a kind of mourning situation, because I know that I'm kind of saying like goodbye to all those memories when I'm writing them. So it's the experience of producing this work wasn't easy, wasn't soft. It was kind of like edgy, like the edges that I was drawing. And about the color palette, I'm glad you brought it up, because it's also very personal how I chose those colors. Let me say that at first, the beach that I'm talking about is in a village, and the village has a lot of trees and green spaces. It's an agricultural place, so it's pretty much I was drawing what I was seeing. And the color palette is actually also, like, has a very personal story, because these four colors are when I was a kid, I had a swimsuit which had four colors that it used to have stripes, and each stripe has, like, pink, orange, and the blue in it. So I chose these colors on purpose, because I used to love this swimsuit very much, and I wore it so much, so many years, until it wouldn't fit me anymore. So it was also kind of like bringing back this love situation that I had with my swimsuit when I was a kid.
That's fine. I think also, I can remember a few of my swimsuits very, very vividly. Absolutely. Until, like, the fabric wears thin and the elastic is worn out. And
There's also something really different about how the whale is illustrated. And I wondered if there's a sort of a different emotion that goes with the whales and with creating the body and the sort of designs on the whales.
Yeah. Like, when we talk about whales, it's also, like, kind of in my memory, because, like, the scene where I put the grandma is talking to the girl, this is actually inspired from my own story. It's the relationship between me and my grandma, and she used to always talk about whales and the way I draw her sitting, not on a chair, but, like, kind of on a rock or something, because she had a small green area in front of her house, and she had, like, chickens, and she used to come out to feed the chickens, and she would sit, and I would sit next to her while she would be, like, babysitting me or something while my parents are not home, and she would tell me a lot of stories about the beach and the whale, and how the whale used to eat the sun. And in my, yani, these illustration, most of the illustrations that I drew are from my own memory of how I used to imagine those stories that my grandma used to tell me. And they're I see them as, like, beside of the lines being edgy, I also see them a bit childish, like they have kind of a childish style in them, because this is how I remember them. Because when I used to be, when I was a kid, this is how I imagined them. They weren't real. I didn't have a photo in front of me to imagine a whale. Of course, I know how a whale, like, I don't know, maybe an outline of a whale, how it could be, but like not with the details. It was also kind of a vivid memory for me.
So we wanted to talk a little bit about sort of the comic scene in general, and, you know, both Lebanese graphic novel and comic scene and across the region. And you were, I think, living in Beirut when you started to move toward comics art. And to me, one of the main features of the comic scene, not just in Beirut, but in Cairo, Casablanca, Tunis, Abu Dhabi, elsewhere, is this sort of comics collective magazine like Samandal or, you know, so many of Tuk Tuk, so many of them across. And I just, you know, came across this new one at the Abu Dhabi Art Book Fair called Kunish. And it seems to be a feature of the Arabic comic scene so much more than elsewhere, at least other scenes that I know about. And I wanted to know from you sort of what role this collective had played in your trajectory, what you think the sort of pluses and minuses of it are, and why it's such a big feature.
I want to start with saying that definitely I was very encouraged to start doing comics because of the generation that was a little bit older than me, not that old, but like the old school Samandals, I was very much encouraged by them, because in Lebanon we didn't have any other comics magazines other than that, and of course the classical Majid and Ahmed magazines, but those were more like children books. But like grown up comics, for me it was like the old school Samandal. So I was definitely encouraged by that. And also Lena Mirhej, like I used to know her from the newspaper that I used to work with, because she used to publish comic strips while I was also working as a journalist in the magazine, in the newspaper, sorry. So she also, when she used to see me like drawing and sketching, she also like kind of pushed me to do this. And like, she used to kind of encourage me like, oh, okay, you do comics. I didn't know at the time that what was I doing, like, can be specified as comics, because I thought that like a comics should be like a classic way of, I don't know, being let's say in a square and like a bubble, and like you need to have hiwar, what's hiwar in English? like a conversation script,
right.
Yeah. So I didn't know that when I started, that was what I was doing was actually can be like labeled as comics. So yeah, I was definitely encouraged by the people who used to create comics, and having this scene all over, like the Arab countries is very inspiring for me, and having these artists who are trying to very hard to create magazines and create more comics is very inspiring for me. And also like being part of it is also something that I'm really happy about. As for the other question, collectives, you want me to comment on the idea of having collectives?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, for me, I am pro-collective. Like, I am really, how can I say that? I'm very interested in the idea of a collective. But for me, what we have is, I wouldn't say that there are a lot of collectives. I would say there are a lot of art groups, which we call collectives. But when we go back to the concept of a collective, I think it should be much more than what those art groups are doing. Let me start with, like, if you are an artist and you want to, like, kind of practice art and live from practicing art. It's not something easy to do, like in this economy or in the region that we live in. And we are very much we cannot work unless we, how can I say, we are kind of controlled by what funders want, what organizations who fund art want. And for now, for some reason, organizations that are interested in comics, they are excited about the idea of the collective. So a lot of time you would say people coming together to kind of create a project, not for the idea of the collective. I'm not practicing what a collective should be, but only to get resources in order to create. Because a collective is much more than just coming together and work. I think that there's a political sense of having a collective. There should be harmony between the members. There should be, they need to have a common goal. There's some kind of a fight between you and the system while having a collective. There need to be a sense of fighting the individualism that the system is forcing on us. So all these, which are the goal of a collective, you do not see in art groups. What you see is just people collaborating together, for me, which is different than what a collective should be. So this is my only critique, let me say. And I was I was involved in many art groups in Lebanon and other than Lebanon, and I was very hopeful, and I'm still hopeful to like find myself in a collective, but this is not happening. I had a lot of good and bad experiences with art groups, but mostly I was disappointed because I never felt that I found a collective that is actually working as a collective. Like you would see, most of the time, art groups who survive, like through years and not end after one or two projects, are the people who were friends before starting this collaboration. This is the art groups that you see surviving. For example,
maybe have a shared vision.
Exactly. So the concept of a collective, which it should be grouping people to work together in harmony and having a shared political belief and try to be more independent and producing art, which is more of manifesting things rather than just waiting for funds and what funders want. Like, for example, if you look at the art scene or the whole creative scene, you would see that we all produce on the same subjects, which are right now popular. And this is sad. And if you talk to any artists, they would say the same. There are plenty of artists who want to talk about different things, but there are no resources to do that. Even my own work, like most of the comics that I share in different magazines or newspapers, I don't choose the subject. They tell me that, for example, I want something about, gender equality, let's say, because this organization or this magazine has a fund to produce material about this subject. So I don't want to, like, when I'm critiquing what a collective should be and when I'm critiquing art groups, I don't want to be harsh on artists because I myself, I'm an artist too, and I know the struggles. But maybe I just want to call things with what they are. Like, I don't think that there are plenty of collectives. We are just art groups struggling in this system.
The problem of sort of, you know, organizing effectively, winning your, you know, intellectual as well as your economic independence, which is always key or almost always key to having, you know, other forms of independence, is one that is people are finding challenging, like outside of the art world too, right? Like, it's really hard to organize with other people, and it's very hard to create collective spaces that are genuinely independent. And I just wanted to connect with a question, because so you've talked about how a lot of comic art and graphic art and art generally, I guess, has funders. Are you talking about international organizations, regional cultural organizations? And then, like, what about the private publishing? Like, is there any way to just produce work for readers and for the market that's not, so it wouldn't be dictated so much by, you know, the criteria of grants and foundations?
Well, this is another black hole that artists fall through when we're talking about, like, the market. Because in this case, like, for example, in my experience, if I want to publish a book, right, and this happened when I was looking for a publisher for Inside the Giant Fish, and dealing with publisher is also, like, it's really a black hole, because it's a very harsh market, and maybe publisher themselves, they're also going through their own, I don't know, problems and struggles. But a lot of publishers in the market, unfortunately, do not respect artists, and they just look at your work as a product, and they just want to sell it. And most of the time, they take your copyrights and they make money off it, and they don't pay the artist anything. So how can you survive if you want to be, like, it's impossible. No one actually right now can survive with only publishing stuff. Like, publishing is not something to aim to live from, because most of the time it's the publisher dealing with your book or your artwork as a product, and they're going to be making money out of it. And they would say, like, yeah, because printing is expensive, I don't know, ink is expensive, we have to market it, we have to do, I don't know, be available in festivals and whatever. So they have their own struggles. But also, I think that the whole process from printing to marketing the book or the artwork, it's kind of not involving the artist who maybe spent years working on this product. So it's kind of like the artist is getting isolated from their own work, which is also, like, very frustrating as well. So for me, when I decided, like, because I used to, like, publish independently before, which is also was another hard thing to do, and I couldn't do it anymore because it's also something that takes a lot of time. It's like a full-time job. So when I decided to finally surrender to the publishing market, I knew that I was not gonna get any money back from it, unfortunately.
So what can you make? What do you can you make money from as a comics artist?
It's working. I don't know, like. But, it's the comics that I publish as comics journalism in magazines, in newspapers. It's the comics that I work with organizations, with nonprofit organizations. It's basically the work that you get commissioned to do, and not the work that you want to do. This is the difference.
Right.
That's very interesting. And can I just, another quick follow-up? So if our listeners want to find your work, where can they find it? Like, where are your books available? Can they be found online?
The
English translations of three of the works can be found at, for buyers in the United States, can be found at mamulpress.com.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe I can talk a little bit about Ma'amul Press, because, like, my experience with Ma'amoul Press was very different from my experience when I talk about publishers, because they work in a different way. And I've been working with Ma'amoul Press before it was even Ma'amoul Press. It started as a collective called Big Mouth. And I published my first zine with them in early 2017. And I'm still working with them right now. And like, this is I really respect what they're doing, because they work differently. And for me, they can't make a lot of money and a lot of success from what a big publishing house can make, but they make sure to pay the artist back, which is something that I really respect. And they really work hard to put the artist, like not to isolate the artist from the work, and they don't take the copyrights also, which is something very important. So if you want to do something else with your work, you can do that. So maybe this is a chance to say that, like, for example, the ideal working in the publishing market right now is my experience with Ma'amoul Press, because they actually work as a... because they are artists themselves, and their main purpose is to encourage artists to produce more, and they don't deal with products with artworks as only products. And I know that they're going through their own struggles as well. I know that them choosing that is not something easy to do.
I believe that they're today, as we're recording, they're having an event for the book at the Brooklyn Arts Book Festival.
That's true.
So they're bringing it out and around. But so I'm sorry, I don't quite understand about copyright. So does that mean if your publisher has the copyright to the Arabic, that you then couldn't produce like a T-shirt with the whale on it?
I can. No, of course I can use the but I can't whenever I want to do anything with the book or anything that's related to the book or the story, I don't have the right to do that. I don't know, everything that's related to the book or marketing the book, or even being like, if I want to participate in a festival, in a book market, I can't do that.
I think what we're talking about is maybe it's this kind of signing off, instead of a more conditional copyright where you sell a publisher the rights to publish an edition in a certain country, like it's like more that you sign it off in perpetuity and totally, this idea that they just bought it for good, it and everything that it applies to. They could bring out editions, as many different editions, or you know what I mean? And even like resell it. Is that what we're talking about? It's kind of like, it's a sort of all or nothing. Like they just, as opposed to, I think it's more common that you don't sign away all your own intellectual property rights over your work that way. And that's just the way the publishing industry works, I think, generally more still. I mean, I'm really not an expert on this, although I love books. I don't know the ins and outs. I wanted to ask you a question, since you've talked a bit about your shift from reporting to making comics, and in fact, the, you know, using still of sort of certain reporting techniques in your work. I recently read and actually wrote something about Lamia Ziadeh's book, with My Port of Beirut, which I don't know if you're familiar with her work. She's a Lebanese-French artist, and she does these books that are graphic novels, but without panels, without dialogue. They're illustrations and text. I think they're very lovely. She did a book previously on like Arabic divas that I really enjoyed. Like it was like biographies of all the great Arabic singers from the early 20th century. And then she did this book that was published in French and now in English. And it's like basically an account of the first 4 months of the blast of the Beirut port explosion and the first 4 months afterwards. And it's, again, it's very repertorial. Like, it's basically day by day. It's almost like a journal of what people were thinking, what they were saying, what images were circulating online, you know, kind of how people were, you know, some, you know, of course, it's her personal story, her family's story or whatever, but how people were experiencing that. And it just made me think, and then I, you know, some of your work, you pointed out Lina Merhej's work, which I think is brilliant. And again, a lot of it is like about current events, about things that are happening. And I just wonder if there's something about the format of comics and of the graphic novel that is somehow a more responsive, like that works better for when you want to talk about things that are in motion, things that are happening, things that are quite current, like as opposed to, I don't know, like writing a novel, that there's something, it gives you an ability to like, there's something reactive about it or like, you know, more in the moment. Do you have any thoughts on this? I'm not sure what my thoughts are yet. I'm just like spitballing here.
Maybe I don't know her work, because if she publishes in French, I have a barrier because I don't understand French.
Yeah, that's probably why. Yeah,
I think we collaborated on a Semendal project before, but I'm not sure. The Catastrophe collaboration, because there were like around 10 artists. I think we maybe collaborated on this project, but. What you were saying about the work being reactive, I didn't think about that before, but that's true. It's kind of like this whole book of Inside the Giant Fish was me being angry about what was happening to us. So yeah, that's right. It is reactive to like current events happening to us.
I was just going to say, starting with the comic strip, which like is published in a newspaper and is like really short and really episodic. And so that one is very clearly almost always about what's something that's like happening, you know, like the cartoon. And but then even when you take it longer to the book form, maybe something about that stays where it just, I don't know, allows you to sort of have a more direct intervention or comment on things that are like happening around you. But sorry, Marcia, I cut in.
No, I just was saying something I found really strange about reading My Port of Beirut by Lamia is that she basically does painted or sketched versions of these photos that you saw online about the port explosion. And it's somehow so moving to see these new versions through the lens of her painting these same photos that, you know, I saw over and over again on social media, to then see them through the lens of her art that is, you know, it's still recognizable. It's still the same photo. I honestly don't know why it's so moving.
It's like
from
she
here,
turns
so striking.
Them into... Just because it's like turning them into like, it's like icons in a way, or like the way you have like, you know, posters for martyrs or something. It's this reproduction of their images as part of this project to kind of like honor the victims, right? Like to remember them. And so she does a lot of the book is just portraits of a lot of the people who died. And I agree with you, Marcia. It's very touching. I mean, I feel like it's a tribute.
Yeah, you know, I'm seeing her work now. She's from Lena Murhin's generation. Like, she's before us. But maybe if she lived in France, this is why I didn't meet her yet. But her work is very familiar. I've definitely seen her work before. Mm.
So I wanted to ask, so you mentioned Lena's work.
I love it.
And what sort of exciting work do you think is being done with the graphic novel in anywhere in the world? And it doesn't have to be, you know, it could be stylistically or formally or thematically or whatever. What kind of inspires you to do new things, or what do you enjoy?
Like what do I enjoy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or what do you recommend? Also, what else should we check out?
I don't know. I'm always looking at what's being published. Like, for example, Corniche, you mentioned it. I also only knew them like a year ago, and I was very excited to see an independent kind of magazine in the Gulf area, because we never hear about such initiatives happening there. And I think that we're also kind of isolated, artists in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt are kind of isolated of what's happening in the Gulf area. And I think it's very nice, to get artists, to kind of connect with what they're producing. But I'm always inspired with what's being produced. Like, I'm always following up with, artists my age, what is there to produce. I don't know. I'm inspired by everyone who's trying to produce right now, because it's not an easy thing. It's not like every artist you meet, they kind of have a side job to survive. So producing in this economy is kind of very hard. So I'm following, I don't know. I'm following, I'm very interested in this, what is produced in this area, because I feel that there's when we talk about comics, there's the manga style, and there's the DC Marvel style. And I think that the region are kind of also organically producing a style for our work. I feel like there is something very common in what we produce in this region. And it's not only the language. It's not only the Arabic language. I feel that we, people in this area kind of broke a lot of restriction when it comes to drawing. And I feel like there's a common, school that it's being created without us actually working on it consciously. And this is if you want to kind of do a research and an analysis about it, I think that this could be found. Right now I'm doing my studies in cultural studies, my graduate degree, and I'm very much interested in this. And I'm I have my eyes open, and I'm trying to my eyes open in this. And really, if you look closely, you feel that there is a new school of Arab art, publishing art comics that is being created right now, because magazines and newspapers are opening space for this kind of art to be presented. Comics in general is being is getting more appreciating, is not looked at as only children book material. So this is very interesting and inspiring for me. I wouldn't suggest one thing, but if you look at book festivals happening right now, you would see a lot of new material, which is very, very inspiring for me. I'm really happy that we're kind of creating very hardly a new market for this, that it's gonna be good for all the artists working in this field.
Mm. So you mean Cairo Comics, those kind of book festivals?
Yeah, and also on a smaller scale, like even a magazine, an art group that creating a magazine, for example, in Jordan also, there's a comics magazine, and although Jordan is very close to Lebanon, for example, like 5 years ago, I didn't know any comic artists from Jordan. It was very sad until they created this magazine that I like, okay, so there's a very tiny market for comics in Jordan.
What's it called?
I think that...
What's the magazine in Jordan? Do you remember?
Yeah. They're going to be so mad at me for...
That's okay. So wait. Is the magazine called Fanzine by any chance?
Yes, Fanzine, of course.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Got it.
I'm terrible at that. So
I was going to ask you, like, you're talking about keeping up with the scene. So for people who are interested in this, how does one, I mean, is it, are you mostly like following people's Instagram? Like, oh, you mentioned like book fairs, but of course not everybody can attend those and they only happen so often. Mm. I mean, I imagine there's the same problems with like distribution that there are with like books in general, that like it's not easy to find everything you want everywhere you want across the region. So like how does one, you know, what are the best places to sort of like know and follow these magazines and these artists? Like, do you have any tips for people who are interested?
Yeah, unfortunately, you have to be available online. Like Instagram is the only, for example, right now, the only platform that you can discover things like that. But like when I mentioned like creating a magazine, and like, for example, let's say Fanzine created a small market for comics. This is why it's important. And I think it's very important. There were like, I don't know, 5, 6, 10 comic artists that they didn't know each other. They were working separately. Maybe no one knew about their work. But then when you make a magazine, you kind of create a small space for those artists to be seen. And it's also like us creating a small market from zero. So right now we know that there are... a group of comic artists in Jordan because of Fanzine, you know, and like Corniche, the same thing. Because of Corniche, we know that, so creating a magazine is something like very important. Like it's creating a space for artists' work to be seen.
A showcase. Yeah. I mean, makes me a little sad.
Yeah, but you're right,
like,
that it
shift to digital is that, Marsha and I are already sad that like we're reading PDFs more than books these days, although we keep fighting this losing battle that like we want, but especially when it comes to like graphic novels and comics, like I just hate reading them online. Like I want, it just feels like something that deserves to be held in your hands.
But it is difficult. Now I'm already regretting that I didn't get all the issues of Corniche when I was in Abu Dhabi, because I don't know, again, how will I, you know, how would I get another one? How will I get the new one when it comes out? So, you know, there is a, you know, serious distribution issue with paper books.
Yeah, this is definitely one of our struggles, Yani. Do we put all our work online in order for it to be accessible for everyone and lose having our work produced as print? Because I myself also feel that I don't like to read digital, and the work is completely different when you read it from a screen or when you hold it in your hands. Like there's a lot of, intimacy and a lot of feelings lost when you don't hold this thing in your hand, like the colors, the texture, everything. Like print kind of create a very personal connection with you and what you're seeing or what you're reading. So yeah, of course we want to see more print. You have to like sacrifice, like when you put your work online, okay, maybe it's more accessible, but you're losing this in your work. And when you decide to print it, you're gaining this, I don't know, you're feeling that, okay, you're happy that people are appreciating this kind of art, but you're also losing it from being more accessible. So, like, whatever you do in this field, you're always sacrificing something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a tough choice.
And, like, I just wanted to say that I myself feel sad when I can't, like, access, for example, Corniche online. But I know why. I don't want to access it. Keep it printed. I'm going to find it someday because, like...
I think they told me that they will be selling it through their website at some point.
I'll
put something in the show notes about how you can find Corniche.
We'll put a lot of links in the show notes to, yes, like, all the magazines that we've mentioned, to the English translations of your work that are available on Mamoul Press, to some of the other works that we've talked about, because, so people can find things. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Rowan. It was really, really nice talking to you. Your work is beautiful. We hope to see more of it and to get other chances to talk to you.
Thank you very much. I really also enjoyed the talk, and I'm happy that I, like, had the chance to also talk about all the struggles and, like, kind of rant about our problems.
It comes up a lot. It's not
it is a common theme.
I think it's worth, like, telling the truth. Like, it's tough. It's tough to be an artist. It's tough to be a writer. Let's talk about it. Maybe we can find some solutions sometimes.
Yes.
Great talking to you both. And thank you to everyone who listened. And goodbye for now.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.